It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, turns out it's okay to be riddled with self-doubt and anxiety when you're making something new, at least according to the co-host of the public radio show Radiolab. We'll hear from him in a bit.
First, the Beloit Police Department asked members of the community last week to voluntarily allow the department to search their homes for guns. The program is part of an effort to stem gun violence in Beloit.
Wisconsin Public Radio has been tracking every gun homicide in the state this year, and so far that number totals 118.
Gilman Halstead has reported on the homicides alongside Chuck Quernbach. He joins us now to talk about the Beloit Police Department's effort and the overall gun deaths in the state. Gil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, at first glance, this might seem a little bit odd. How would you not know that there are guns in the house, for example? Well, you spoke to police chief in Beloit, Norm Jacobs, last week, though, and this is what he had to say.
Some people have asked me that question. How could that be that there's a gun in the house that they wouldn't know? Well, everybody's perspective is different. There are people in our communities who don't have control over their own lives. They don't have a control over the bedroom that's next to them. They don't know what's in it. And it's possible we could find a crime gun. That's really what we're looking at. Or find a weapon that's unknown to the persons who are in charge of the house. Maybe we'll find a toy gun that's been altered by a youngster in the house. And we know the tragedies that occur there on occasion.
So, Gil, as you were talking to the police chief, what was his prediction for whether people will step up then and therefore take advantage of this program?
Well, I think that's an important thing to mention. He said that he didn't expect the phone to be ringing off the hook for this, that to a certain extent the goal of the program is to get people thinking about guns in their house, even if they're not ones that they don't know about. The campaign also includes recommendations for how to secure guns that are legally in your house that you know that are there. It encourages trigger locks and storing the gun without ammunition, all the safety things that police have been saying for a long time. And I'm sort of guessing he didn't say this specifically to me, but that to have this proposal for a search would get people talking about everything that has to do with guns. And it's been important in Beloit this year because they've had a jump in the number of gun homicides and actually non-fatal gun incidents this year over the past year. They've had, I believe, 7 actual homicides and quite a few more gunshots fired and people injured. So I think all of those things went into their decision to try to launch this. But it certainly got some interesting reactions on our website.
What are the highlights there?
Well, people seemed amazed that anyone would want to do this, and I think we're outraged. Some people were outraged at the police for even suggesting it and saying that there were people suggesting that it was a way for police to get in and search for other things that could then be used because the person had consented to have the house searched. There is a protocol sheet of paper that the police will be using to, if they get a call, and it'll be really clear what they're searching for, and the person will sign a consent form. So it seems unlikely to me that some of the concerns that were being raised by folks who thought it was a terrible idea are really legitimate. But there was some discussion back and forth, too, of people who were trying to focus on some of the positive things. I mean, this issue of whether you might find a gun that a child had the little orange tip that shows that it's a toy gun had been taken off. Perhaps the parent didn't know about that. And we've just had a couple of those this year, one fairly recently that led to a child being killed by police.
And are there any precedents for a program like this? It seems like it's a brand new concept, at least in our area, but have other police departments tried it out?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they had. Chief Jacobs didn't know of anybody else trying it, but I have a feeling it has been suggested in some form or another in other states. I'm not sure if the sort of way they chose to put out a news release on it is similar, but I don't think it's completely new. I'm pretty sure it's pretty new to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that this is an attempt, hopefully, to raise the awareness and public dialogue among the community about guns and gun safety. Does he have high hopes that that'll be a success?
Well, they're trying all sorts of things in Beloit, and I think that they hope that that all of them will have an impact. I think sort of generally the other aspect of this for the police department is to try to encourage better relationships with the community, to have actual face-to-face conversations with people about issues of crime in the area and try to build up trust. We know that, especially right now, with what's going on across the country with the police shootings in Ferguson and in Ohio, that it appears that trust of police departments is not really high right now as a result of that. And that doesn't help police try to solve crimes or prevent them. And so I think that that's another reason in terms of timing why it may have come out right now.
You've been tracking the all-gun homicides in Wisconsin during the past year. Why don't you walk us through some of the significant figures that you've collected?
Well, Veronica mentioned 118. That's the total that we have for gun deaths. We've been focusing our reporting only on the homicides. Mm-hmm. And so that 118 actually includes some suicides, a couple of accidents, and five deaths that resulted from self-defense by people who were defending themselves against someone else with a gun. But in terms of homicides, there have been 103. And I think, not surprisingly, most of them have been in Milwaukee, and far more than half. There have been, to date in Milwaukee, I think there have been 70, which is actually down, or it could be down for the total for the year. We can knock on wood and hope that there aren't another 10 gun homicides in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee anyway. There were 80 last year, and we're at 70 right now.
Well, Gil, in our last 30 seconds here, how did this match up with your expectations for the year? Would you say that, what did you expect?
Well, we expected to be able to get a sense of what kinds of situations were causing these gun homicides. In terms of the numbers, I think we weren't really sure. We didn't expect a huge jump or a big drop. But I think we're seeing not surprising trends, and it had to do with the drug sales and robberies for the majority of them.
Well, Gil, thank you so much for being with us today. We've been speaking with Gil Halstead. He's WPR's reporter who follows criminal justice issues.
You never know what Jad Abumrad will say. The Radiolab host is known for his quirky storytelling approach to science as he tackles deep, mind-bending material. So he might be thinking big. Or he might just be thinking about the sanitary habits of badgers and his visit to the Badger State.
Do you know what I learned about badgers? Speaking of Wisconsin, I learned this morning. They have communal toilets.
They
dig a hole, and the entire badger posse, or whatever they're called, goes and poops in the hole. and the hole is very far away from their den, whatever it's called. But they all use it. So I've never heard of that with an animal. But I was like, wow, badgers.
Even winners of the MacArthur Genius Award think about badgers once in a while. That was Jad Abumrad, founder and co-host of the hit syndicated public radio program Radiolab.
With the success of Radiolab, it can be surprising to know that Abumrad goes through what he calls gut-churning doubt as part of his creative process. He joins us now to explain how he uses that dark, biting insecurity as fuel for innovation. Jad, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, as the guy who hosts a hit radio show and has a MacArthur Genius Award to his name, I think it might surprise people to know that you have, sometimes in your creative process, a gut-churning insecurity. What did that insecurity feel like when you sat down to create Radiolab?
Back in the Stone Age, when this show began in 2002, it was then a very different kind of show. It was like a three-hour show late on Sunday nights that no one listened to, like literally no one. But I didn't know that, so it felt like the stakes were super high. And I was super green, and I just remember I remember hours, maybe 2 hours, trying to track like simple line like, "Hey, this is Jad. Welcome to Radiolab." I would try that line for like 2 hours to try and make it sound like me. And I would go through like, you know, all the voices in your head that you have when you're new, trying to expel those voices and get to your voice. That would take me hours and hours and hours, and I would feel like a fraud and all those what I now feel are normal feelings when people are trying to make stuff. That was the feeling at the beginning. And it's funny, like the middle and now the late middle, whatever period we're in now, is still punctuated by moments that feel that way. And so, you know, the gut churn as this thing I'm talking about is, I feel like it's partly an attempt to sort of reclaim that feeling and be like, you know what, I think this is a useful feeling. I feel like this is the energy that makes creativity go. And so, it's all throughout the process us, not just me, but for all of us.
Do you think people are upfront about that, that it is kind of this wrenching time of self-doubt and trial by error? Or do you think there's pressure out there to act like, you know, it comes out of the box perfect and ready to wear?
Well, I can't really say, but I do know that it's something that I hadn't seen anyone talk about. There's all this sort of stuff that's sort of like almost like Silicon Valley inspired about disruption and about failure and about innovation and about this and that. But I hadn't actually seen anyone talk about what it actually feels like when you're in the middle of those things. And when you're trying to do something new and you don't have a template for it and you're scared, you're not quite sure why you're so scared, but somehow you feel like you might die. And you're just doing a radio show and you're asking yourself, why do I feel this way? I haven't actually heard anyone talk about that experience. And so I just started thinking about it. And I started doing a bunch of interviews with like poker players and like Cherokee shaman and weird people like that who all have interesting things to say about the utility, it turns out, of those feelings. And I just thought, this is kind of interesting. It's changing the way I work. It's making me think differently about how to manage a group through a process of uncertainty, and it might just be worth speaking about out loud. So that's kind of why I'm coming, is because of that.
Well, for those of us who can't actually make it to your talk, which is coming up, what did the Cherokee shaman say about why that's a useful feeling?
Oh, gosh, it's one of my favorite things ever. Let's see. To set it up, there's like a really interesting difference to consider. Like when you're in the process of creating something, there's a difference between the kind of fear that is useful and catalytic and it'll ultimately push you towards something great, and then the kind of fear that's paralyzing. And that's always an interesting question that you have to ask yourself. And the Cherokee have this idea that any fear that is not your fear, but it's been given to you maybe by a boss or someone or like – from social media, whatever it is, any fear that's been handed to you from the outside that isn't your own, the only logical response, they would say, to that fear is to kill it. You can't negotiate with it. You can't listen to it. You just got to kill it. And so they do this thing. They train as adolescents. They train in this thing called hunting the dark spirit, which basically it's a process they learn of lucid dreaming where they fall asleep, wake up in their dream, identify what they call the dark spirit or the dark creature, which is that fear embodied somehow in their dreams. And they literally hunt it. They'll like hunt it with a spear and kill it. And that's their way of trying to identify the externalized fear and actually eliminate it, exterminate it. And I like that idea because I like the thought that there are some things that don't have utility beyond just you just have to make them go away. And that was part of the, you know, things I was thinking about. And when I learned about the Cherokee and thought back to some of my own creative experiences, it was really useful. And I was like, God, I wish I had known about the Cherokee before this. It could have saved me so much trauma. But yeah.
Do you think you did kill off your fear in the process of creating Radiolab?
I don't know. I mean, it's sort of like for me, I find every story has a little bit of that toxic doubt in it, and you have to kind of kill it as it comes up. And so it's a constant process, I find. You know, there are stories you do and they're like great stories and they come out easy. And then there's the other kind where you're trying something new and it doesn't feel comfortable and you're taking a risk which could easily just blow up and you feel stupid. And nowadays, when people are listening, that's a different prospect than back when people weren't listening. And so in those moments, you get really scared. And then it's always interesting to me. I think, okay, what would a Cherokee shaman say right now? I think, what would they say about this feeling I'm having? Is this a feeling I should listen to or not? And so I sort of think about them. I think about the Cherokee way of being in those moments to try and figure out what are the good fears and what aren't.
Now, you were talking about how that feeling of being completely confused and lost in the woods as being something that's vital, a big part of that creative process. And most of us spend our lives trying not to feel that way. I mean, it's not a comfortable way to feel. Why do you think it's actually a good place to seek out when you're trying to create something new?
Well, it's like that time-lapse photograph of that we've all seen of like the seed bursting out of the pod and through the soil. I mean, it's messy. It's probably painful for that little seed. And we've created all this language around these feelings of like this, that we've all this like about pain and about avoidance. But like, guess what? There's no life without that feeling. The seed couldn't actually get out into the air without that traumatic point. And so I don't know. I just find like it's nothing more than fundamental. It just is. And the moment you start to think of it that way, I found for me, it's just really helpful to know that this is just part of the process. It's part of the path. And so when you begin to really take that in, it becomes like, oh, I'm feeling this way. Hello, old friend. And you begin to see these feelings as just part of the not something to avoid, but something that actually lets you know you're doing the real work. You know, that maybe something will happen that's good.
Once you've got something that becomes something, you know, you're not working on this newborn radio show, Radiolab, anymore. You're working on the hit, widely listened to, widely respected show, Radiolab, and it's, you know, it's become a thing. Once you've hit that point, are you still trying to bust through to birth new things, or do you feel a pressure to maintain this Radiolab brand that people know and love?
Both. It is a thing now, and like there's a lot of things that depend on that thing. Like there are people that work for the thing, and there are people who create underwriting messages for the thing, and there are membership messages that go out on the thing, and there are newsletters that the station sends out about the thing. So it's suddenly really hard in the middle of all those dependencies to be like, you know what, this thing should be a different thing. Instead of a circle, let's make it a square. Like, it's really hard to suddenly make those kinds of moves when the thing is at this stage of thingness. So, but what I think of it this way, it's like, I think of it weirdly probabilistically at this point. Like, if we're going to do five expressions, like five stories, I'll give myself three that can be like the last time we did it. So there are three stories that I'm not going to say they're going to be easy, but they're going to fall into familiar forms. But those other two damn well better make me sweat. Damn well better make me hurt a little bit. And like, that's the balance. Like, you get three hall passes and then you get two that's got to be a little bit painful. Not too much painful, because then that would be irresponsible, but like a little painful. And so you internalize that sense of balance. And so, I mean, I see the group doing that now where like we'll have an editorial meeting and we'll all just sort of collectively be like, you know, we really need to do something that's kind of stupid and kind of crazy. And then that leads you, like, for us to do these experiments. Like, we just did a whole hour on like the legal foundation for the war on terror, which was like a whole wonky legalistic counterterrorism deep dive, which is not what we've ever done. And it gave four of the staff the flu, you know, because we crashed and burned on it so hard. But like, it felt like that's what we needed to do at that point, because we had done a couple of stories which felt, again, not easy, but sort of familiar. And so I feel like it's a budget. Like, you got five things, spend three on what you know and two on what you know you don't know. And like, that's the balance. And that's the only responsible way to do it when this thing is already a thing. I mean, when you're when you're brand new in the world, you can experiment all you want to. But we kind of have to take a certain number, but not too many experiments at the moment.
Well, how do you know which one of those is the right one? Does it feel just right in your gut, or is there something else?
I'm not sure you ever know. I feel like it's, again, playing the odds. Like if you're going to tell 5 stories, you got to chase 20, knowing that 10 of them are going to die, and you're left with 5 that you might put on the shelf, and then 5 that ultimately make it to air. And the 5 that make it to air, by virtue of the fact that you've chased so many, they're going to be the ones that you never expected to work out, you know? So I feel like that's the key. There's some kind of weird, like, probabilistic math. And that if you just place a lot of bets and you're comfortable with the fact that most are going to fail, well, then a couple will sprout. And it'll never be the ones you expect.
I wish we could keep talking, but we're out of time. Jad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jad Abumrad, host of the popular public radio show and podcast Radiolab. You can catch him at 7:30 tonight at the UW-Madison's Memorial Union. Well, he'll present a public lecture called Gut Churn. For more information, check out our Central Time Facebook page.
Anger over events in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York City have poured into streets across the country and across social media. It has also led to some face-to-face conversations and deep soul-searching on racial matters. UW La Crosse recently held an open forum to talk about racial issues. As Maureen McCollum reports, they're exploring how to make the community a more inclusive and safe place for people of all backgrounds.
AJ Jackson thinks about race every day. The UW La Crosse sophomore says she doesn't always feel comfortable on a campus that, as of last fall, is 89% white. Conversations about race and Ferguson and grand juries have not been taking place in Jackson's classrooms. She needed a place to speak her mind and hear what her peers were thinking.
I am a black woman, so these issues really do hit home for me in the community and just things that I think about every day, things that really touch my heart.
That's why Jackson came to the UWL Open Forum, Healing After Ferguson. As part of the program, a wide variety of voices stepped up to the microphone, some people defending police officers and others calling out inequalities on campus. In UWL's 2013 Campus Climate Survey, students and employees of color reported being more likely to experience discrimination and be bullied or intimidated by peers. Jackson says it's time to have tough, honest, and regular conversations about race on UWL's campus. She says it's not going to be comfortable.
We all have to listen to our own point of views, and we all have to come together as a society and realize that we're never all going to see eye to eye on the topic of racism, but it is important to address it, and it is important to remain calm and to remain open-minded and understanding in these uncomfortable situations.
There's a push to have similar events more frequently on campus. UWL officials also hope more people submit hate incident reports when they experience or witness discrimination so the issue can be handled. Another step is moving the conversation beyond the campus borders and into the greater La Crosse community. UWL graduate student Shondell Spivey helped organize a protest in La Crosse after a grand jury decided not to indict a white Ferguson police officer in the death of an African-American teenager.
Ferguson, you know, is the gasoline to ignite the fire that has been happening systematically with racism and oppression.
Spivey has been working with the La Crosse Police Department, trying to develop a relationship among officers, UWL students, and communities of color.
La Crosse is growing, right? Like, whether we want it to or not, La Crosse is growing. And there's a lot of black families here that were affected by that decision. And we want to make sure that our police department is not operating in a biased way towards people of color.
Police Captain Robert Lawrence says he wants to build on those relationships too, especially with people who have negative perceptions of police. He says he became an officer to serve the community, not divide it. Earlier this semester, Lawrence sat on a panel about knowing your rights. Next semester, he'll teach a seminar aimed at educating the public about police use of force.
Unless we start having these conversations and try to breach this void where people hate me because of this uniform I wear. We have to start talking, we have to start understanding, we have to start getting real about, you know, what this is all about.
Lawrence says that's not going to be easy.
This ranks up there with, you know, solving world peace, and you know, because that's really what it is about peace. It's about understanding, it's about, you know, it's about hatred, and I think there's a lot of things to work on.
And Lawrence says he's proud to be part of that conversation. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
The United States is in the midst of its most profound demographic transformation since the baby boom after World War II. In 2020, the census is expected to show that minorities make up 40% of the country's population.
Demographer William Fry is with us to talk about the shift to a nation with no racial majority and how this will impact life in the United States. He's a senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and research professor in population studies at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of The Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you today.
Well, demographics are always in flux. What makes these current demographic trends so remarkable to you?
You know, I look at numbers all the time. I'm kind of a census geek, and you know, been doing it for quite a while. And when I looked at the results of the 2010 census, we've looked at some of the projections, and we've looked at what's happened in the last couple of presidential elections. It's pretty clear to me that this is a pivotal period in the United States for racial demographic change and racial change in general. I point out that a big demographic phenomenon that people are very understanding of is the baby boom in the last part of the 20th century. It affected everything. It affected lifestyles, family changes, women's roles, everything. But I think the new diversity boom that we're having in this century, in 2050, people are going to look back at this period right now and say this is a transformational period in the United States, and it's the new young, growing, diverse minority populations that are going to be leading the way toward our growth, toward our productivity, if we do things correctly, if we plan appropriately for it. But people are going to recognize this if they haven't already in big ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's break it down just a little bit. First of all, paint a picture for us. What will the country look like in the next 50 years?
Oh, well, in about 50 years, we're going to be what's called a majority minority. you know, it's hard for me to say because we use the kind of racial categories we use now, whites, Asians, blacks, Hispanics. The multiracial population, as a result of probably several generations of people marrying folks of other racial and ethnic backgrounds, will make those categories completely obsolete. So even the idea that we're less than 50% white, which is if you do kind of a mechanical projection ahead, would show that. But I think it's going to be we're going to be much more blended than that. And there'll be a big Hispanic influence. There'll be a big Asian influence and still substantial numbers of people with at least grandparents and great-grandparents who call themselves just black or just white, but it'll be a very blended society.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that will manifest itself among society? Well, first of all, let's just talk about breaking the country up a little bit. What trends will we see in certain parts of the country?
You know, I think that, you know, part of this transformational period that we're seeing now involves population shifts across different parts of the country. If we look back to, say, the early 1990s and you thought about where do most of the Hispanics live and most of the Asians live, you would pick out a few metropolitan areas like Los Angeles or New York or Miami for Hispanics and San Francisco and Seattle for Asians. Not all of those groups live there, but a very high percentage of them. And a lot of the interior part of the country, to the extent there was a minority population, was primarily African-American population. Well, all of that has started to shift inward, especially into growing parts of the country in the Southeast and in the Mountain West. I've calculated there are 145 metropolitan areas that I call new Hispanic destinations. These are places that have grown very rapidly in their Hispanic population. Still not a big, big population there, but it's that rate of growth which is making them part of a dynamic population in those areas. The other thing that has continued to go along, and people have not really recognized it, I think, as much as they might have, is a continuing black migration to the South. It started in small numbers in the 1970s. Of course, a lot of people who read American history know that blacks had left the South in big numbers in the 20th century. But starting in around the 1970s, blacks started to move to the South a little bit, and I would call that more being pushed out of the North. There was a lot of deindustrialization. Race relations were not very good. A lot of race riots. We talk about the riots now or the difficulties now, but it was, compared to then, those were really kind of difficult and brought a lot of blacks back to the South. But in the last two decades, I would say it was more of a pull rather than a push. The South has become economically prosperous, and considerable black populations, professional middle-class black populations, have emerged in states like Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, and Florida. And young people who are African Americans are more likely go to the South when they move than to any other region. And as a result, the South has continued to become and continue to be a black-white region as it becomes more prosperous and as more African Americans move there and are prosperous. So these are some changes that we've seen and will probably continue to see.
And yet, you also point out the while there is this trend toward a more prosperous black population down in the South, there are still statistics across the country about racial disparities, poverty in the education system, the criminal justice system. Can you help explain why there seems to be these two competing or contrasting types of statistics?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to sound like we have or even close to solving the issues with racial disparities in the United States. Back in the 1960s, we had the civil rights laws and the civil rights movement, and I think people thought when we got to 2010 or 2014 or 2020, a lot of things would have been wiped away, and they're not. There are huge disparities between blacks and whites, between Asians, between Hispanics and whites. With respect to Asians, who are doing by and large a little bit better, still have to deal with confronting obstacles to getting promotions and advancements and so forth. So I don't mean to say that those problems are gone. What the book does say is that the demography is so powerful in the United States that as we move ahead to 2020 and 2030, there's actually going to be a decline in the white population and an aging of the white population. So most of our youth population, most of our younger labor force population will be racial minorities. And when we have that situation, these folks are going to have much more clout, not only in the ballot box, but also take positions of responsibility. You know, back in the 1960s, when we did have that civil rights initiative in the United States, only about 15% of the population were racial minorities. In the 2020 census, as you noted at the beginning, more than 40% of the population will be racial minorities, and more than half of the people under age 30 will be racial minorities. So it's a slow-moving pattern. We're still going to have to deal with these issues, but I think it's going to be much more in everyone's interest to deal with these disparities when we have a minority population that's becoming more mainstream and more numerous in our country.
We're talking with demographer Bill Fry about his book, The Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. And we'll look at how those demographics will affect things like politics in our own neighborhoods.
And we want to hear from you. How do you think this increased diversity will change America? Do you think this is good for the country? And where do you see it taking us as a country and a society? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with demographer Bill Fry about his new book, The Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America.
And we're taking your calls, too. How do you see changing demographics changing American politics? Do you think it's a good thing for our country to have soon-to-be no racial majority in particular? How do you think politicians will respond to this increased diversity? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. William, what generational gaps will come about as a result of some of these changing demographics?
You know, I think this is one of the challenges that we have in the United States as we have this generational gap going on. I made the analogy to the baby boom earlier that we now have a diversity boom, not a baby boom. Back when the baby boom was young, we had something called a generational gap between kind of the older population, which is more establishment, and these younger hippies and Woodstock generation folks that had all kinds of ideas of what they needed to do. Well, we're now facing another generational gap. It's probably even more serious, and that's something I call a cultural generation gap. Most of the young people today, very soon, in about 4 or 5 years, more than half the people under 18 in the United States will be racial and ethnic minorities, Hispanics, Asians, African Americans, multiracial, and other minority groups. Whereas if you look at the older part of the population, especially people over age 50, more than 70% of them will be Anglos, and the biggest racial minority population will be African Americans. So they have somewhat different ways of looking at the world, and some of the surveys that have been taken show that these older folks are a little bit resistant to embracing the change, especially the change toward diversity, especially new immigration to the United States. And as a result, you know, they're not as open to just not only the acceptance of these younger folks, but also when it comes to politics and how they vote. They tend to vote for issues that don't provide for a safety net, for better education, for the kinds of things younger people and young adults want. As opposed to things that they're more interested in, such as medical care and Social Security. And that kind of generational gap translates into politics. I think we've seen some of that in some of the presidential elections. The Republican candidates in the last two presidential elections got a lot of their votes from the older and whiter parts of the population. Barack Obama got a lot of his votes from the younger and more minority parts of the population, not just because he was an African-American, but because of the kinds of policies that he and the Democratic Party represented with respect to the younger population. So I think that eventually, given this huge demographic force that's coming along, both parties are going to understand that they're going to have to think about the needs of the younger part of the population, as well as baby boomers who will soon come to realize that if they want to have those Social Security checks coming in, it's going to have to be generated by the productivity of these younger minorities as they make their way through the labor force.
What I'm hearing you say without actually saying it is that there's a lot of adjustment that we all need to be prepared for, both on a systemic level but also individually. How do you recommend going about that, to be prepared for the actual tangible changes that we're going to experience in our lifetime?
You know, I think it takes some very important leadership. I think people need to be made to understand why this younger population deserves to have investment in their future, because it means that the country is going to prosper. You know, I'm vain enough to think that people should read my book to understand this, because, you know, I do play out all the demographic forces that are going to be coming into play. But, you know, I think corporate leadership, political leadership, local communities, churches, and so forth, these are the kinds of folks need to speak out. I mean, oftentimes we hear some politicians try to play on these fears that older people might have toward sort of new minorities coming into their community. And, you know, I think it should be the reverse. And I hope it will be the reverse. I think we have a history in this country of reaching out to people from other parts of the world. We are a melting pot country by our historical standards. And I do think there's enough of that in our DNA that eventually people are going to come to realize that.
So as we move into a future where there is no particular racial majority, do you foresee a society that is more understanding of one another, or one that is more divided?
You know, I'm optimistic about being more understanding of one each other. And one of the reasons I'm optimistic about this is because it's the younger part of the population that appears to be more open to accepting people from different backgrounds. This is the part of the population that is already seeing interracial dating, interracial marriage, much more open ideas about immigration and about what the government should do to help folks get a leg up in our society. So I think as those younger people keep, aging and they have kids, the attitudes will change, and it will even change among the older population, I think, as they see the direction our country is moving toward.
Some people get anxious when they hear about the phrase, or when they hear the phrase minority white. But why might it be a good thing, something that one should embrace as they hear about this boom in minority populations?
You know, one of the reasons why this is important is we're becoming a globalized world, a globalized economy, I should say. And as we get more connected to other parts of the world, not only in our economy, but in our, social media relationships, it's very important to have that understanding of different people across the globe. And that's what we get from these younger people. That's what we get from New Minari's first, second, and soon third generation folks from Latin America and Asia and other parts of the world that are going to be a dominant part of our population, a dominant part of our workforce, a dominant part of already a dominant part of our classrooms at the high school level and in the college level, and dispersing out to different parts of the country. So, you know, I'm just optimistic those divisions are going to fade. The old days when we had sort of just whites and then another minority kind of separated in very high levels of residential segregation, not that much interracial marriage, I think that's all going to turn around.
And in our last minute here, what's your takeaway for us as neighbors, as individuals who start to see this demographic shift taking hold in our lives?
You know, I think we need to take kind of the broader view. A lot of the places where the challenges are greatest are where the new minority growth is something that just occurred. You know, we don't see as much of these challenges right now in places like California or Texas or New York City, much of New York City anyway, where there's been many, many decades of minorities moving in and being part of the mainstream. A lot of it is in these kind of new areas like a suburb like Ferguson, where the institutions have not yet come along to sort of deal with these changes. I think individuals should kind of look around what's going on in the rest of the country and try to do what they can on an individual basis to make things better for their neighbors.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for being with us today.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
That was William Fry, Senior Fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and Research Professor in Population Studies at the University of Michigan. He's also the author of The Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America.